Hello, TSF family. We wanted to start off by saying thank you. Thank you for listening to this podcast and for your hard work to love yourself more and for your feedback.
Can you believe it's been 3 years that we've been doing this spiritual fix, and it has been such a beautiful labor of love for Anna and me.
We have loved doing this work. We've loved hearing from you, and we love exploring ourselves and each other alongside our listeners.
We wanted to put out the call for 3 ways that you can help support us to support you.
One, we would love you to leave us a review on iTunes or follow us on Spotify.
2, drop us an email and let us know how much the podcast means to you.
And 3, you can donate monthly or even just once to our PayPal patronage.
Every little bit helps, and we are so grateful to those of you who have donated already. Thank you.
You help make this podcast possible.
Thanks, y'all.
You can go to our website, www.thisspiritualfix.com, for information on how to pledge as well as to email us. Hello, TSF family, and welcome to episode 14 of season 6 of This Spiritual Fix. Today, we are going to be re-looking at the humiliation wound with some added information of what we've learned since. Enjoy.
Hypnosis. Mindfulness. Meditation.
Mama.
Past life regression.
Mommy,
This Spiritual Fix. Two Mystical Mamas Hacking the Self-Help Game.
With Anna Stromquist
and Christina Wiltsey.
Hello, Christina.
Yes. Hello, and welcome to the Humiliation Wound. Recap of the Primal Wounds.
A.K.A. Nurse Ratched, according to your villain profile.
Yes, according to my villain profile, it's the Nurse Ratched, because the Nurse Ratched is very concerned with humiliation in terms of really, really wanting to always appear to be right and to never, ever make any mistakes, which relates to the fact that I have been working on my Nurse Ratched and my humiliation wound hardcore, and now I am not afraid to learn Spanish and actually speak it.
Tell me more.
So basically, imagine that there is a me every single time that I can read languages, I can understand a lot of languages, not totally. I definitely have a limitation but I kind of have refused to speak them because I don't want to be embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I all of a sudden have been working on my humiliation wound, and I'm just like, I just want to learn languages. I just like literally want to learn all the languages right now. It's just
all
like
all of them.
I am doing mostly Spanish, but I'm also doing like, I'm learning some Navajo and I'm learning some Greek and like things that I've just wanted to learn for so, so long. And I am doing it because I don't care about making mistakes anymore. I'm just like, why would I miss out on being able to speak another language just because I like don't want to sound stupid? Like, I'm just like, fucking bring it on.
But Navajo,
there's nobody to speak Navajo to. I think I'm just interested in that. I just think I love the sounds, because that's one of the things, like, to me, voice and sound and overtones and bija mantras, you know, the ones that like are associated with the chakras, like those are all so interesting to me. Like, sound and language is so fascinating to me, and yet I've always limited myself because I've been afraid of making mistakes.
Really?
Yes.
What are you afraid of?
I am afraid of just being humiliated. I don't know why. I just like, I want to be perfect at things when I do it. And like, even now, I like try so hard for it to be perfect, and then Mercury retrograde messes up a recording, and I'm just like, what? I literally did everything I was supposed to. And you just, like, you know, it hurts me in my soul to be thought of as incompetent.
I think, with the exception of the French, pretty much everyone, though, is
Accepting
and like touched when someone is trying to speak their language.
Yeah. I was on Buford Highway the other day, and I had like, I ran into a bar, like a padded bar.
Oh, yeah.
At Catch Air, because it was a yes day with my kids, and I literally like every single vertebra.
Catch Air is an indoor jungle gym for kids, by the way.
Every single vertebra in my neck went out, and it was incredibly painful, and I was like nauseated, and I didn't know if I had a it was like, it was really, really bad, and I had, and it was only halfway through the day, And I was on Beaufort Highway, which is very, there's like a lot of international places there and they don't speak English. And I went and went into the Hola, you know, tienda, like, you know what I mean? Like the whatever convenience store that was like, and the woman looks at me like, oh shit, like she can't speak Spanish. And I had to try and get ibuprofen.
But you did it.
I did it. I did it. I didn't care. I was like, mi cabeza es mal. I was just like mixing all these languages together.
But she probably, she understood. I'm sure she was touched.
Maybe. Maybe. Yeah. But, and you speak it.
I have a funny story about that.
Yeah.
About
yeah.
Something humiliating I did once is I was living in Costa Rica and this woman hired me to translate a cookbook from Spanish to English. And I was doing great. And then like a couple years later, I realized I made a really bad mistake, which was like one of the ingredients that she kept talking about was nuez moscada. And I didn't, I should have double checked, but I'm like, nuez moscada, that must be mustard seed. So every incident of nuez moscada, I translated into the English as mustard seed. And then fast forward, I'm like reading a recipe in Spanish and it's like semilla de mostaza, which is seed of the mustard. So I'm like, that must mean mustard seed. So what the hell did I write was mustard seed? It turns out nuez moscada is nutmeg.
Oh my God.
So somewhere, and I don't know how, and I was so humiliated and I wanted to like reach out to her and apologize and fix it. But like at this point I had no record of who she was or where she was or whatever. So yes, there is a Costa Rican cookbook somewhere with desserts in it that have that the ingredients are mustard seed. Which, if you're familiar with Indian cooking, it's like
it's savory.
It's not a dessert flavor. It is not nutmeg.
No, it's not. Oh my God.
So there.
Yeah. So there. It makes me feel better about how I might mess up any other.
I feel bad about that, but
right. And it also just reminds me of all those different times when I was like a chemist and. When I was first starting off as a chemist and I like had to do the most basic stuff in the lab and had no clue, there's like a lot of times when we can like in hindsight look back at something and be like, that is incredibly embarrassing. This isn't language, but I remember I once actually put salt in a formulation that I was making and it like actually went into production and then people were like, my laundry machine is rusting, and I was like, no, fuck, I put salt in it. It was like, and so I had to take the salt out. Like, I literally probably, like, ruined a couple of laundry machines. And I, like, always felt so deeply embarrassed about making that decision. Because salt, sodium chloride is a fixative for dyes.
Okay.
So it makes it so that it's less likely to bleed. But there are much more sophisticated ways of doing that.
So who were you making laundry detergent for?
I was making it for the place I was working in New Zealand. It was an environmentally responsible cleaning products company. And I had formulated...
So you sold it to people?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It went into production. Like, thousands and thousands.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's humiliating.
I'm sure they don't listen to this, but thank goodness I fixed it. Like, once I figured out what was going on, I just needed another chemist who was going to, like, peer review it and be like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, don't put salt...
So how did you figure it out?
It was because somebody peer reviewed the thing. Like I was literally like 24 years old. I had only worked for a major cleaning products company for like 2 years. And I was in surface products. I was like in hard surface products. I did not do laundry. And yet I had to figure out how to formulate laundry products and for other surfaces. Like I had to figure out how to do dishes and laundry because I had to make like a whole suite of environmentally responsible cleaning products. And so it was only when somebody came in and was like, hey, I want to like, who was consulting to, because we were going to like hand over the work to them, that they were like, why would you put salt in this? It was like one of those like embarrassing moments where you had to like pull me aside and be like, you have blood on the black of your dress. Like that's what it felt like. It was so humiliating.
I have a few thoughts in my mind of times in my life where I've been humiliated. And I will replay them in my head every now and then. I'm like, to what gain? The people that were involved in this story have probably never thought about it since.
With humiliation and the humiliation wound, you know, the technically the mask, according to the woman who originally wrote about it, who I cannot remember her name right now.
Burbo.
Lisa Burbo. She says that the mask of the humiliation wound is the masochist.
So maybe when I replay my humiliation stories, I just want to hurt myself.
Maybe.
Just want to...
But maybe you get sexual pleasure from being masochist. Because technically, the way I love that masochism and sadism...
So I get sexually turned on by remembering the time that I was totally stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that's what she means by masochism. I feel like people have... started to miss, like, masochism directly means like punishment for sexual gratification, and sadism does too. Yeah. And yet I feel like we use it as like someone enjoys self-harm.
Did you see the movie Sanctuary?
Uh-uh.
Okay, so it's a really good movie with Margaret Qualley, the daughter of Andy McDowell's in it. Mm-hmm. And she plays basically a dominatrix, but she's not a dominatrix like she shows up in all leather. She shows up just looking normal, but then what she does is she humiliates the dude. Uh-huh. And he gets very turned on by it. And anyways, it's so funny because I told my husband about it. I was like, we should try that sometime. He's like, okay, stupid.
That's totally an Eric response.
For like a week, whenever I called my husband up, he'd be like, I love you, stupid.
But I appreciate the fact that she says it's masochism. I would argue that it is... The mask is perfectionism, I think, more so than anything, which...
Really?
Yeah, honestly.
Don't you think perfectionism is more injustice?
I don't, in the sense that... Oh, I think that ultimately... I mean, it's hard to say. Okay, so if we use Nurse Ratched as the example, Nurse Ratched was so concerned with keeping everything in its hierarchical place, which is something that I've also noticed as a humiliation wound, is it's all about hierarchy and everyone needs to stay in their place. And you use shame to get people to stay in their place. Like, right. Culturally, there's so many people who use shame as a way to keep people in caste systems, keep people in, you know, in certain levels.
Or get
your
children to behave. Like, yeah. I don't do it. I try consciously not to do it, but I know it's so easy if you want your kid to do something to just be like, well... That's easy enough.
Yeah.
Or your brother does it.
Yeah. It's the enforcement of levels, and that one person is better than another person. And so maybe that doesn't look like perfectionism. Maybe perfectionism sits more in the injustice wound. But I think that people who are consciously trying to rescue themselves from humiliation become perfectionists, right? Because they don't want to become humiliated. So they become a perfectionist, which means that they basically can never... And maybe that is masochism in the non-sexual way, because masochism, you could say that masochism is, I'm going to harm myself. I'm going to purposely harm myself by not putting out anything that I want to do because I'm so afraid of being humiliated. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think you could probably take it both ways.
There could be a sexual side of it.
Mm. Because it's in the root chakra. It's in the root center. It's like that humiliation wound, the shadow chakra, sits directly in that space.
Right.
Yeah. So for me, I can say that, like, I experienced a lot of shame as a result of never... I mean, this is a little bit more kind of... I experienced a lot of humiliation as a result of, like, not being a girly girl, like, not even not being a tomboy, just being, like, a ragamuffin. That was the word that was used, an orphan. That was the word that was used.
Who called you a ragamuffin, and what does that mean?
Oh, my stepmother did. Ragamuffin is, like, a term for, like, you just look disheveled all the time. Like, you don't look put together. You look like you don't have anybody taking care of you. Like, that's why I was called an orphan, too, which is a little bit on the nose. But, like, my dad, he would, like, go around and he'd always wear, like, his white undershirt around the house.
Uh-huh.
And, like, we would never have, like... You know, we would not look put together. Like, we would have, like, holes in our clothes and, like, all this kind of stuff.
Your hair wasn't brushed.
Yeah,
right.
Hair wasn't brushed, all those different things. And then, you know, we were basically said that we were, like, shameful for being that way. Like, people were, like, my stepmother was, like, ashamed of us being in public as a result of it. And so in some ways, I feel like this kind of...
Your dad would only wear that shirt at the house.
Right. But that wasn't acceptable. Like, that was not acceptable to my stepmother. Like, it was a point of shame to her.
That he wore comfy clothes in the house?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, he needed to wear a shirt to the dinner table and not, like, just an undershirt to the dinner table.
Okay. Well, that I could see.
Maybe. But I experienced a lot of humiliation, and I think I've only recently started to recognize how much it's affected me. And as a result, I am doing what I consider to do for what I call the control villains, which are like the one, I won't get into this any deeper, but basically the nurse ratchet requires, humiliation requires, tries to get control as a result of being shamed. And whether that's through perfectionism or through, you know, trying to put other people down, trying to control other people so that you can be above them. And so the way that I've gone about trying to heal my nurse ratchet is, for one thing, not caring if I speak and I, like, speak Spanish and I fuck up, right? Like, you know what I mean? Just being like, I'm going to say it and I don't even care because I have a need and I'm not going to care because I can do this. Like, I'm going to be brave. But also just not caring as much about the fact that, it's desensitization therapy to the fact that we are, like, I'm going to make mistakes and I'm going to make them all the time. And I'd rather face them than not, right? Mm-hmm. And I've said it in the past that I was like, hey, I'm going to become rejection proof by just making lots of getting rejected all the time and, like, putting myself out there. But I didn't really do that so much. I think that because most of it sat in humiliation for me. Like, I'm so afraid of making mistakes. And I'm so afraid of coming across as incompetent.
And you think your stepmom used humiliation,
yeah,
as a teaching method versus, like, yes. How else, what would have been, like, a healthy way to get you to brush your hair, for example?
That's the thing. It's an interesting thing because I experience it right now with my daughter, is that, like, the only way that I know to do it is to just be like, look at how beautiful you look once your hair is brushed. Right.
But then she could internalize it like, I'm not beautiful unless I brush my hair.
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, I'm just saying,
fucking,
like, how do you...
brushing hair. I swear. It is, like, the source of so much fucking trauma for so many people. Like, either they're neurodivergent and they're super hypersensitive to having... They're, like, tender-headed and they do not want somebody to pull their hair. Or, you know what I mean? I'm just like, this is such bullshit. Like, why do people have hair? And why do we force kids to, like...
I've always kept my daughter's hair in a bob because of it. It's just...
Right. But my...
It'll go crazy.
Yeah. And I... My kids, no matter how ridiculous they look, they're allowed to choose their own haircuts.
Oh, well, my daughter chooses the bob. Like, I would choose it, but now she chooses it too.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But...
So...
Because I've said, you can keep it long, but the way I've gone about it, trying not to do the humiliation thing, is like... I've just said, if your hair is short, then we can brush it with no tangles very quickly. If it's long, it's going to take longer. It's going to hurt more. So how do you want your hair?
Right. You don't see it. In some ways, you don't treat it as a choice. It's just a fact.
It's like if you have long hair, it's going to be a bitch. I don't say bitch to her, but I'm like, it's going to be a bitch to take care of. If it's short, it's easy. Which one do you want?
Right. And maybe that's the problem that I have, is that to me... taking care of is an option. Do you see what I'm saying? Like the way that I feel like
mine is either short and easy to take care of or long and hard to take care of. And you're saying it can be long and difficult to take care of. I mean,
or long and you don't have to take care of it, or you could take care of it. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, you choose whichever way you want. Like, I'm trying to say, like,
but your child's hair is very different than mine too, because your daughter, your daughter can go 2 or 3 days without brushing her hair and it's still, like, you could still run your fingers through it.
Yeah.
If my daughter with long hair goes more than 24 hours, you cannot run your fingers through it. If you wait 3 days without brushing, there are dreadlocks in the back.
Right. Right.
Because she's my hair.
My daughter's is like that after like a week.
Okay. So see, mine, it has to be brushed every single day and detangled every single day because it becomes matted and impossible.
Right. So it's very similar to, I feel like, all of the Southern women who could not leave the house with wet hair. They couldn't. Right. It was unacceptable. Like, it wasn't even an option. Right. So it was like, you can either come up with the best thing possible for how you're going to get this done in the most efficient manner, or it's going to be difficult, but it's going to get done either way. You know what I'm saying? They like make this implacable standard that's like, you cannot leave the house without being taken care of. Mm-hmm. Whereas for me, I never had that, but because in some ways you could think of it as that my stepmother came in very late after the fact. So it was still like, we had been unkempt for fucking years before she came in, and she didn't have the authority to be able to be like, you're not leaving the house unless your hair is brushed.
How old were you when they got married?
I was like 13, but they got together when I was 2. Didn't matter, because there was like a... I mean, it was just a fucking mess of things in there. But the whole idea being that, like, I thought it was a choice that I could either go out without my hair brushed or I could go out with it brushed. And I would be shameful if I went out without it brushed, but at least it was my choice. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
And I feel like that's where I'm with my daughter, is that I'm giving her a choice. Like, she can go out with her hair crazy. And then I'm like, okay, so am I embarrassed because it's embarrassing that I'm not taking care of her hair, or is it embarrassing to her? Like, I feel like it's more a reflection of me not doing good mothering if her hair is not brushed. Right. So it's shameful to me, and she doesn't care. So should I care? Probably not. Right.
Yeah. I don't know. I totally get what you mean, though, about the shame of it all.
Yeah.
Like, I don't say ragamuffin, but I say homeless. I'm like,
yeah.
And I tell them, I'm like, I've said to my kids, I'm like, if you don't let me brush your hair, your teachers are going to think that your mom doesn't take care of you.
That's it. And it's so funny because it is totally a reflection of us. Like, and I always get so frustrated with my husband because I'm just like, fucking brush her hair. Like, just make it a part of her morning. Like, because I'm working most days and he's the stay-at-home dad and he homeschools them. I'm like, can't brushing just be a part? Can't you guys just, like, can't she, like, play with slime and you can brush her hair and, like, that just becomes a part of your thing? But because he doesn't think of it as shameful, he doesn't enact it.
Because he's a man, which is exactly what happened to you. You were raised by a man.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so hard. It's so hard. And so that I haven't quite untangled, obviously. I'm sorry, it's such a bad pun. I haven't untangled that one. But I think that, you know, from the other perspective of just like, I am really embracing making mistakes and just recognizing how much of life I have not really experienced because of the fact that I was afraid of being humiliated. Right.
And languages. What else?
Languages, writing. Like, I posted a blog a couple of weeks ago. It was about overcoming the nothing, and it was literally the first blog that I had done in six years. Yeah. Yeah. I can genuinely say that I feel that with writing, with speaking another language, with just putting myself out there at all, something is shifting inside of me. Because I am desensitizing myself to the problem, the like making mistakes. And I think it just happens naturally when you're the one who's responsible for everything, like maybe starting a new business and having my own business and being totally having to be the only one in charge of any of the things that are happening. And therefore, if any mistakes happen, it's me.
Yeah. But so ultimately, you think if you make a mistake, you're not worthy? Or what is it?
Ultimately, I feel like if I make a mistake, I literally feel my fight or flight coming up.
So it's about survival.
It's about survival.
Maybe there's like this ancient part. Have you talked to the dinosaur part of your brain and been like, we no longer rely on social networks like we did when we were cavemen and like...
Right. But do we not?
We do. But do we need acceptance as much?
I don't know. I mean, I live in a small southern town. You know?
But you're not going to starve. You're not going to get stoned. You're not going to get your house, like, pushed out of your house just because people don't like you. It's not like the caveman days.
But that's not the case, I don't think. I think that is the case. In small southern towns in particular, like...
No one's going to push you out of your house.
No, maybe not, but I don't know. It's, I mean, CPS, there's always that.
Yeah.
Right.
If you look homeless, their CPS is going to take you away from me.
Yeah, or they're going to come question us about homeschooling or anything like that, right? I mean, it's just, it's, I fundamentally felt as if I was, if I consistently did things that were shameful enough, I would get into an abusive situation, right? Like, I would get into a place where I would be, like, abused. Verbally and emotionally abused as a result of making mistakes, especially, or doing shameful things. Making mistakes with my appearance, things along those lines. And so I do have PTSD as a result of being humiliating. If I was humiliating to somebody else.
Oh, you were humiliating.
If I was humiliating. If I made a mistake. If I didn't do it right. And that's just like...
So do you think that she was embarrassed by you?
Yes. Oh, she was definitely embarrassed for me. I mean, I had to write a letter that basically said, you're not responsible for how I turned out. Like, I literally...
Hers.
I had to write, I was so tired of being the object of her attention and like her being so upset by the way that I was turning out and like wanting to be so directly involved and like fix me. That I basically just wrote a contract that said and signed it and said, you're not responsible for how I turn out.
Her therapist made you do that?
Yes, and gave it to her. And to her now, that's a point of pride to her, where she doesn't recognize that to me, that was like writing myself off. 100%. I was like 12 or 13. And so, you know...
That's a weird thing for a therapist...
It was really unethical.
But do you think the therapist was trying to save you?
Well, I did. I was the one who suggested it. But this is the thing is like when you're 12 or 13 years old, the magical thinking you have to be like this magical contract is going to make the abuse stop.
Right.
Is not a thing. And anybody should know that. Right. Like any good therapist worth their salt. It didn't help. It didn't help. No.
Not even a little bit?
No, we had to change the environment for it to help. Like that was we basically both got into a position where we didn't know what the fuck we were doing. And that was how we could come together. But until then, the dynamic stayed the same. And, you know, I wrote myself off both physically because I stopped caring about how I looked. Right. Like I kind of, not entirely. There were definitely moments and resurgences throughout, like when I started to realize I was like, oh, I'm kind of attractive, you know, like there were definitely surges of that. But in general, fuck, I was like, I didn't care what I look like ever because I didn't want to adhere to it. I was like, I don't care if I'm shameful to somebody else.
And by that, you mean messy hair?
Yeah. Messy hair and not brushing it. Like I remember once I did this Photoshop class back when I worked at a library, I was like, and I videotaped it. And I hadn't brushed my hair, and I was like, I look so fucking bad. Like, I understood her point. You know what I mean? I was like, I look so bad because I had this, like, huge cowlick of a hair chunk on the side of my face. You know what I mean? So it's just like, I don't know. It just, so for me, really coming to terms with how shameful I was and how much I was, someone tried to control me because of how shameful I was, really made it so that it felt like, you know, now that I'm taking that narrative back and I'm making it so that I feel like I'm not going to die if I'm humiliated or if I make a mistake, my whole world is opening up. And I feel like a lot of people don't necessarily connect with the humiliation wound in the same way. Like, I mean, we're even having trouble finding somebody to interview who says that humiliation wound is their primary wound, right? And you know, I feel like there's something to be said for that. So just to kind of speak on this, to get the victim, rescuer, and persecutor perspectives from humiliation, I would say that the victim, and you can say if you agree with this, the victim would say, I was humiliated, and I wasn't, and therefore I wasn't good enough, right? Like that I was like, I did something that was shameful, right?
Okay.
And so then
you become a self-persecutor when you do that.
Exactly. Right. And so that's where it gets confusing because it's like you can either stay in the victim place of being like, I'm never going to be good enough. I'm so shameful. I'm not going to come out. Right. And that requires an internal persecutor to keep you in that place, right? So the internal persecutor says, like, I cannot allow, you know, I'm not good enough, so therefore I'm not going to put myself out there, right? I'm going to purposely, like, it's not even a withdraw. It's like, I'm going to purposely put myself lower than other people. Or I've also seen it that people put themselves purposely higher than other people. So, like, so much, you know, saying that you're smarter than other people, saying that you, you know, are more competent or that you're more capable of holding power. Those are other ways. Like, I feel like there are two ways that you can take it. You can take it as putting yourself down and below other people, and then other people put it so that they are above other people. Mm-hmm. And then the rescuer, if I had to say the humiliation, I don't know if the rescuer really shows up in the humiliation wound so much, other than wanting to rescue other people from being humiliated. But I feel like that's not necessarily a bad thing. I can't see how that's bad right now, maybe.
Maybe the rescuer is trying to prevent humiliation. Like, if you brush your hair, then when you go out, you won't be humiliated, kind
right.
of thing.
Right, and neither will I.
And neither will I.
Yeah. Yeah. If I can sex. Sex.
Good morning! How are you, Anna?
Good morning, Christina. And what a morning it is.
Oh, man. It's been a morning. We're finally out here in my little Milledgeville compound. Anna's come out here and with a really good night's sleep, right?
I slept. No, actually I didn't. We'll go into that later in the episode. I'll explain.
Okay. Looking forward to that.
My humiliation voice just woke me up in the middle of the night, shaming me. And then after about an hour and a half, I was able to go back to sleep, but I will talk about that later in the episode about the shame.
Okay.
AKA yeah. humiliation wound.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, so we're out here in the Milledgeville compound and we had to get our audio set up for a second. So it's going to sound a little bit different, but I think it still sounds just,
hey,
I think it's
but we're great. In person, you guys. I just want you all out there to know I drove 2 hours to her farm, even in the age of Zoom, because this episode is worth it for us to do it in person.
Exactly.
So it's going to be better mm-hmm. for you. It's going to be deeper. It's going to be, well, I don't know what it's going to be because it hasn't happened yet, but we believe that doing it in person is so much better than Zoom.
It is. It's there's so many levels of frequency that don't come through computers in the same way easily. I think maybe it would be something we could evolve to do, but like right now I can tell you as like a psychic who can read different energies, like I can still see the person, I can still read it because I've attuned to that, but in most of the time you can't. Most of the time you're not seeing all the different levels of a person.
Yeah. I just need to be with you for this episode.
Yeah. So what's going on in the world? What's going on with you? I guess you've told me that you came out here.
Why don't you tell me? We were talking last night a little bit about omens and signs, and yes. I would love to hear more.
So I love this as a psychic counselor, or not a counselor, but like a psychic. As a psychic coach, I feel like signs and omens, particularly when it comes to numbers that people see and nature things that other people see, like it's kind of one of the things that people feel is their feedback loop to know that they're doing well, right? To know that either right. that they have to pay attention to something or that they're on the right path. And I love it because I feel like it's the best way to feel like the earth and God and the exterior world is supporting you.
Right.
Right.
Can I give a little example for mm-hmm. someone not familiar with that? Like I had a friend who was telling me, this is just last week, she said that she was listening to a podcast talking about numerology and how certain numbers show up in your world to like as omens. And she was like, I wonder if my number is 888. Because she or 88 or something, and because that's just a number she resonates with. She looks up from her car, and right in front of her, the license plate was something something 888. While she's listening to that podcast, mm-hmm. and later on that day, she's like, "Universe, send me a sign if I should do X, Y, or Z." And she went to pay for her food and the food came out to $8.88. So she, you know, she texts me telling me all this. And that's just an example of like people who anchor to a number or a sign and then they use it to get confirmation from the universe about a question they may have.
Yeah. And I, the thing I love about this is that it's one of those, in its most perfect form, if everything is us, right? So if we're like, if we get into the oneness state, right? The fifth dimension, seventh dimension, whatever you want to say. Like if you get into this state in which everything is you, then it's so easy for little manipulations to happen in the outside world to give you confirmation that you're doing the right thing, right? Because you just like, you're like, there's a part of your brain that always knows what time it is. And so we'll always look at the clock at 11:11, right? Like there's a part of you that you're basically like, and you're choosing to activate your brain to have a good feedback whenever that happens.
A good feedback loop.
Yeah, like that there's a, so you're creating a behavior pattern of looking at the clock when it's saying 11:11 or
4:44 for me.
Right. And mine's 11:11, yours is 4:44. And so that's like what it does is that you know that you're in the thick of the oneness and the fact that your brain is saying, I need the confirmation. Like you're asking for the confirmation to say, am I on the right track? And then the universe is giving it back to you. When it comes to nature stuff, which is what we're going to be talking about in a future episode soon, it's another interesting thing, right? Because there's all sorts of patterns and there's all sorts of things and coincidences that you can see. But like when something feels anomalous in nature, like seeing like, you know, four hawks going in a figure eight or something like that. But that, you know,
herd of deer on your yard.
Yeah, for no reason. Something like that. When you have a nature moment, when you have one of those moments that really makes you feel like the world is bigger, that you've been given a gift of seeing something that you normally aren't allowed to see, like you're seeing behind the nature curtain, it feels like a confirmation. And so what I just wanted to say about that, though, is that there is another side to omens and prophecies, right? In the sense that we can become really, really reliant on them, right? And when that happens, it's like, it's because we are the feedback loop, if you know what I'm saying, because we drive the ability to see those coincidences and the ability to look outside and see behind that nature curtain, like there are deer in your yard maybe all the time. And like the fact that your brain is aware of all of these different things that you aren't even aware of, like you're giving yourself a grace to be able to like look out the window at the right time. So when you're not seeing signs, it has a feeling, you have this feeling like, oh, things aren't going well. Or in some cases, it's a self-sabotage thing where you feel like, oh, I'm waiting for a sign that tells me that I'm not supposed to do what I've been doing for the last however long because I'm getting itchy feet. So it's like, or because maybe this isn't the right thing for me and I'm not used to committing to things or things like that. And what I think is really, really important to recognize is that the signs and omens come from yourself. And if you know that you have a self-sabotaging cycle within you, like if you have that cycle, like we've talked about in previous episodes where I have this self-sabotaging creative cycle, I can't look to outside sources to know my own truth. Like even if the outside source is me still, right? Like even if it's the external world, does that make sense? So it's like by doing that, you're allowing too many outs, you're allowing too much, what can tend to happen is this experience of apophenia, right? Which is the experience of seeing patterns that aren't there because our brains are wired for patterns, right? And so, oh, I just got 3 green lights in a row. That means that I'm supposed to be going to work on time. Or I just got, you know, something that
the license plate in front of me was 4:44. So it means the guy that I like is going to call me or, you know, just
right.
Like
you can connect anything in your want. You can connect anything in your mind to this. And I think I want to be like I love omens and prophecies. And I think that they have a very clear and healthy place in our lives to like, let us know that we are, that give us the positive feedback loops that we need in our own life, whether or not the mind generates them because the mind is the universe. Or the universe generates them, or God generates them, or whatever. All of those things are important, but you have to make sure that you aren't externalizing your truth. Like that you aren't externalizing and you're not waiting for a sign, like an external sign, to be able to go forward with something, because actually maybe you're dealing with one of the primary wounds, right? And like you don't recognize that there are actually other things here that are going, but like your kind of go-to is to look for omens. So one of the things that I've told a friend of mine recently when we were talking about this is I said, when this happens, and we know this is happening in your life because it was definitely happening in her life, I was like, you need to be very, very clear that any sign that comes as like a, oh, like we need everything, like pay attention to this, has to be incredibly obvious, right? Like it has to be like, holy shit, like this is the craziest, most amazing coincidence I could ever imagine. Like, look, it's a snake in a hawk's tail that's then being like, you know, that's then like under the backdrop of the full moon or something like that. Like it's literally like a one in a million chance of ever seeing something like that. And what that does is it makes it so that you can still create the opportunity, because those opportunities are there for something brilliant to happen and for that external input to happen, that external messaging to happen, but you're not using it to fuel patterns that you are trying to possibly grow out of. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's the idea.
To piggyback on that, I saw this quote and I think it's so true. It said, if you're looking for an omen or a sign to make a decision, you've actually already made your decision. You're just looking for the courage to actually make it.
I love that.
And I think that's true. So if you're the kind, if you're sitting there and you're saying, okay, if I see, you know, three doves today, or, you know, if my lucky number pops up, it means that I need to quit my job. You're already wanting to quit your job. You're just looking for an excuse or confirmation. So just ask yourself, maybe when you're if you're the kind of person who, if you're the kind of person who does these little negotiations with the universe, hey, if I'm supposed to do X, show me Y. Or if I need to know X, show me Y, whatever. I need to know Z, show me
X.
I need to know B. I need to know B, show me C. Like if you're over here making negotiations with the universe, maybe don't look outside the universe so much. Look at yourself and be like, why am I asking this question? Mm-hmm. Why do I need confirmation from the universe? What's behind the question that I'm asking? Because I think if you look deeper into the question that you're even asking, you already know the answer.
Yeah.
And you're just looking for an excuse to make it, to make the decision.
Yep. I completely agree. And also if it's one of those things, some people use those numbers to say there's a message waiting for me. It's like a voicemail, like, ooh, I see 1111 and I see 4440, you know, I have 444. That means there's a message in my voicemail.
Can I give a really great example of what of a message I did get with this?
Yeah.
Oh, or is that going to
No, go for it.
I hope this doesn't like contradict everything we said, but like since we started the podcast, I started finding dimes all over the place. I'd be cleaning out my car, there'd be one single dime. I'd be like doing the laundry, one little dime was left in the laundry machine. I'd be walking down the street, I'd see a dime. I kept seeing dimes everywhere and I was like, this is important. There is a message here. I don't know what the message is, but I'm going to take them. I'm going to start collecting all the dimes I find. So I had a little bowl and I started putting the dimes in there. I kid you not, since we launched this podcast 10 weeks ago, I've collected 9 dimes. Okay. That's pretty significant considering I don't normally come across dimes.
Coin shortage.
Yeah. Right. Especially since I only use a debit card. Anyways.
Yeah.
So I was like, there's a message here and I don't know what it is. I'm just going to keep collecting the dimes. Well, I found out what it meant because the universe does talk to us if we listen. But I wasn't negotiating. I was just like, there's a message. I'm going to wait and see what's revealed. Mm-hmm. I was in a patient's home and on her coffee table was a single dime. And I looked at it and I was like, oh my God, there's the dime again. And we're having a conversation. And she starts to tell me some advice that she was giving me about motherhood. And at the end of what she said, you can take it or leave it, but that's just my 10 cents. And it stopped me right there. And I'm like, there's my message. There's a dime 2 feet away from us on the coffee table. She just used the phrase, that's my 2 cents, incorrectly. She said, that's just my 10 cents. The phrase is, that's my 2 cents.
Yeah.
She said, that's my 10 cents. Again, the universe is like, exclamation point. Pay attention, because she was saying the phrase completely wrong, but completely appropriate to the dimes. So when she said, that's just my opinion, that's my 10 cents, take it or leave it, the message was, You don't need to worry about others' people's opinions of you. That's what the dimes were showing me, because since we started the podcast, I've been checking our chart rankings. Yes, we've been ranking in the top 200 in the USA and lots of different countries. And I kept looking at the podcast ratings to validate people like our podcast. It's a good podcast. No, the podcast is good because we feel it's good. We don't need external validation. Mm-hmm. And so the 10-cent message was, it doesn't matter what people think of you. Take it or leave it. That's their 10 cents. So that was the message. And since it's happened, I've only found a dime once.
Because you got the message.
Because I got the message. Thank you very much, universe.
Yeah. And but that's the whole thing, right? When you get the messages, when you get the indications that are like your, I mean, not like anybody has a blinking voicemail light anymore, but, you know, like not even a voicemail. Those were answering machine messages. That's what they were called back there when they actually blinked and you had an answering machine. When you feel as if the signs are telling you that you have a message, that is, again, your internal feedback system that says, very much like Anna did it, in a very, very healthy way, which is either, there's two ways that you can deal with it. One is you can say, oh, my light is blinking. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to push the button. I'm going to listen, right? If you feel like you're adept at doing that, and maybe that's just meditation. Maybe that's automatic writing. So something where you're just like, I'm going to write down whatever comes into my flow of consciousness. Or what I love to do sometimes is I'm very good at responding to questions. Like my psychic ability is very triggered by somebody asking me a question. So I ask myself a question. So I'll be like, hey, what's my message? And then all of a sudden it'll just be random things and I'll either be able to say it out loud or I'll be able to write it or type it. And that's how I can actually actively answer my voicemail. The second thing that I can do is I can do like what Anna did and just be like, all right, I need this to be incredibly obvious.
Yeah,
to
like
tell
for
me, what
me
the
I kept getting the dimes. I'm like, what does it mean? I Googled, what does the number 10 mean? You know, it didn't have any significance. I was like, I don't really know what these dimes mean. But universe, if you got a message for me, just let me know and make it clear. And it couldn't have been more clear than her saying, well, that's just my 10 cents.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so funny. I have to say, I'm gonna get like a little bit really even further out here right now. So one of the validation things that I have in my life is tinnitus. Is it tinnitus or tinnitus? I don't know. I always call it the ringing in your ears, right? A lot of people get that. But I also get orbs. At first, I thought my vision was failing. I seriously did. Because they just start floating, and they're these really bright pinpoints of light that just like, that always are existing like in the periphery of my vision and not like directly in my vision. And so as I was just saying that to y'all, I literally had three orbs that showed up while I was talking about it. So for me, it's like my little form of internal validation that says like, hey, I almost feel like it's like catching a glimpse of like what I can imagine the fifth dimension is when you like break through and everything's super bright. And I've had past life regressions where I've had experiences where I've like gone back in meditation and seen like what it was like to go from the fifth back down to the third, and it gets all dark and heavy and it's terrible. So I like always imagine what it's like to go back up, like to kind of come back up into a different level of consciousness. And that's what I always think of the orbs. That's really out there. But I just wanted to say, sometimes it's just a really nice validation that you're saying the right thing. So enough about omens. Let's get into humiliation.
Enough about omens. Let's talk about humiliation. So in Lisa Bourbeau's book on the primal wounds, she says that most people don't have the humiliation wound. So for a long time doing my quote unquote self-research for this episode, actually in all of 2020, I thought, well, I don't really have a humiliation wound. And as I probed deeper, I realized that the humiliation wound is actually probably the bottom of the bucket. It is the most common wound that we all have, but it is layers, layers, layers deep below the surface that we might not even recognize it or see it.
Yep.
I wanted to give a quote from the Dhammapada. When Gautama the Buddha died, within the few days or hours after his death, they pulled all the people that he had facilitated getting enlightened together. They were called arhants. They said, let's get all the arhants together and we're going to make an oral history of everything Buddha said. Let's do it fresh while it's in our mind. So the Dhammapada comes from that. It's the direct teachings of Buddha. So in the Dhammapada, there is a phrase. When Buddha first got enlightened, the very first thing that he said when he got enlightened was, O house builder, you are seen. You shall build no house for me again. All your rafters are broken. Your roof tree is destroyed. My mind has reached unconditioned nirvana. The end of craving has been attained. So what does that mean? Buddha says, oh, house builder, you are seen. I know who you are. The idea is that in order to take birth again and again and again, something pushes us forward in life. That's karma. Mm-hmm. What is karma? It is the desire to suffer. Okay? Karma is, or we could call it sankhara, if you're more familiar with Pali, the desire to suffer. Mm-hmm. And we only take birth to suffer. Maybe this is not making...
No, it does.
We only take birth to come out of suffering. So when you reach the attainment of nirvana and you're enlightened and you no longer suffer, you're not coming back in this earth, to this earth. They call it the non-returner. Buddha did not come back. After he got enlightened, he didn't come back.
Yeah.
We keep coming back and back and back. We are propelled forward by our karmas.
Yeah.
And so when you find the householder, meaning you find the person who is building your houses, building your lives, your bodies, your need to live again over and over and over again, when you get to the end of that.
Yeah.
You.
Yeah. So I have a really good example. I have a good example of what this means, because I was trying to explain this to somebody the other day and it finally, a way of saying it made a lot of sense. So, you know, like when you're in a pool hall. Right. And you're in a pool hall, and I think of karma as cause and effect, because momentum and like the movement of the billiard balls when they hit each other is exactly what is happening. Right. Because it's like, and just imagine a billiard table, like a pool table that's just as big as the universe. And all that's ever happening is you're shooting your billiard ball at somebody. It's hitting somebody else. It's causing a cause and effect that is just like perpetuating infinitely. Right. Which is what you can look at it in the macrocosm, as well as the microcosm of subatomic particles and the way that they interact, like of the way that they're everything has an equal and opposite reaction. So think of life as when you're in one of those pool halls where you have to pay for the next game, like the ball goes into the thing and it sets up the next game. So all of a sudden you have like all of, you know, you have all, oh my God, I can't remember how many billiard balls are at this point, but you have all of them set up waiting for you to... like start your next game, right? So basically all your karma is just going back into the holes, and it's like, hey, look, ready for you to pay up and do another life. And so what happened when Buddha became enlightened was he watched the billiard balls in his own life hitting each other, and then eventually he stopped reacting. So it was almost like he would watch somebody try and hit his ball.
And it wouldn't move.
So he never pocketed any balls to be able to create a new game.
Right, right. I love that analogy. Well, why do I bring it up in the humiliation wound? The reason being is that the humiliation wound is the most fundamental wound that we all carry, because it is the womb of shame, and it is the wound of guilt. And the mask that you wear with the humiliation wound is the masochist. And what is a masochist? Someone who causes themselves suffering. So... we could say that we take life in order to come out of our suffering. That is basically the goal of life. If you want to approach it from a Buddhist perspective or an enlightened perspective, the idea of life is to recognize and come out of suffering. And in doing so, you become an enlightened being.
Yeah.
And what is suffering?
One of the things that Anna said earlier, which I think is like one of the things that will unlock this while we're describing it, is that she was saying that we all have a desire to suffer.
Right.
Right. Which to y'all listening, if you're not familiar with this, sounds really kind of out there. Like, it's like, what? I don't actually desire to suffer. Right. But then you get into this place where you're like, okay, so when you recognize deep down the self-hatred that we've talked about a lot, right, which is this desire to almost punish yourself continually for whatever reason. Whether it's, like I say in The Course in Miracles, where you're just like projecting your unconscious guilt because you want to get back to oneness, or whether it's because of Buddhism and you want to just get rid of all, like whatever it is, you're in this experience of wanting to, of continually roiling in self-hatred. And that is where the desire for suffering comes from, right? Is this continual desire to either out of ignorance, or just because you're constantly trying to fill this hole that you feel inside yourself. And so whatever it is, that feeling of desire to suffer, and suffer is, I mean, Right. Well, yeah, go ahead.
Well, Buddha says that there's three forms of suffering. In the Dhammapada, Buddha says, you know, people will misinterpret it and he says life is suffering. No. He doesn't say life is suffering. He says life has suffering in it. There is inevitable suffering in life. The haves and the have-nots will all experience suffering, whether through old age, birth, death, illness. Like, those are four things we cannot escape. But on top of all of that, there are three fundamental causes of human suffering. One is ignorance, which is ignorance of what causes you to suffer.
Yep.
That's a big one. That's a huge one. Number two is craving what you do not have. And the third one is not wanting what you do have. So in a nutshell, those are the three top causes of suffering. And ignorance is a huge one, because when we suffer, most of the time it's out of ignorance. Mm-hmm. We're ignorant to why we're suffering. He said this and now I'm upset and I'm suffering and I don't want to suffer. I don't want to suffer. No, he said what he said. Whether you want to suffer or not is actually your decision. And the closer, the deeper you do your self-help work, the deeper you self-reflect, the deeper you meditate, the more you go into the self yourself, the more you come to recognize that everything outside of you, it's true. Nothing really outside of you can control how you feel. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you decide if you suffer or not. So when we say you want to suffer, sorry, but you are responsible for your own suffering. You really are. Like, it might be a hard truth to swallow, but at the end of the day, people can do what they're going to do and things are going to happen. You ultimately get to decide if you suffer or not.
Yep. Yep.
And I think that's a hard one for a lot of people to swallow, because it's so easy to say they caused my suffering. But when you do that, you're just rolling deeper in ignorance.
Yep.
And that just makes suffering stronger.
So there's a mudra, and Anna's pointing right now. She was pointing, and there's a mudra that my yoga teacher used to teach me, which is when you point at somebody, one finger's pointing at the other person and three fingers are pointing back.
Right.
Right. And that's the mudra, is this understanding that you're like, you did this. And then it's like, oh, actually, there are more fingers pointing back towards me than you.
Than you. Right. So after giving this little intro about suffering, I'm going to go a little more into the humiliation wound itself. So the humiliation wound is all about shame and guilt. It's about lack of freedom, self-imposed rules or externally imposed rules. It's about debt. In some cases, it can even be about obesity, lack of pleasure, shame for the body, shame for bodily functions, shame for sex, shame about money, like lots of shame, lots of guilt. And there is also this perceived audience, such as the perceived belief that someone outside of you or even inside of you is watching you and judging you. A perceived audience watching you and judging you. And that is what sets us apart from the animals. So animals don't experience deep suffering or depression because they're not sitting around with this invisible audience saying, you could have been a better gorilla. You should be a better gorilla. And the gorilla's like, I'm not the gorilla I could be. And then the gorilla is suffering because they're holding themselves to an impossible standard that comes from the external invisible audience. If we think of it like humans are different than animals because we have this ability to self-reflect, but it's not even self-reflect. We impose an invisible audience. We impose an invisible audience upon ourselves. I think it comes back to a really good analogy is the Bible story of Garden and Eden.
Of the fall from grace and original sin.
Yes, if you want to talk about that, Chris.
Yeah, so basically, most of you guys know this story. The basics of the story is that Adam and Eve lived in bliss in the Garden of Eden. They had everything that they could possibly want. And then a serpent, which is a representative of wisdom, a serpent came along and convinced Eve to eat an apple, which is why we have so much misogyny in the world. Sorry, sideline. Convinced Eve to eat the apple. And then from that, she became aware that she was naked. So she became ashamed.
External audience.
External shame, audience. Guilt. She became aware that she was, and then she obviously convinced Adam to eat the apple as well.
Bitch.
Bitch. Totally evil women. And she convinced Adam to eat the apple, and then they both realized they were naked, and they both felt shame for the first time. So basically, first chakra, shame, survival. They questioned their survival, and they questioned. They started to become ashamed. And that was literally the original sin, was shame. Like, in the, depending on your interpretation of it's different. And then, you know, you also come into, like, just to kind of briefly go out into a lot of mythology that's come around. It's interesting you said gorilla, because there's a great series by Daniel Quinn called Ishmael, in which a gorilla tells these humans, basically lectures to these humans for the whole book.
I never read it.
Yeah, I can't believe you said gorilla. Like, there was like, whoa, yeah. Okay, so apparently I need to mention that. That talks
signs.
Signs, omens. It's little guiding breadcrumbs that you're supposed to talk about this. Basically, Ishmael talks, is a gorilla who talks to these to this person about how the original sin, it was the separation from God. It was the original separation from God in the sense of like, not like when you had everything that you could possibly want. And then you're just like, actually, I don't trust nature. So I don't trust nature anymore to take care of me. Right. Like, I don't think I'm going to, I have to store things for the winter. And I have to lock up the food is what he says. He says, you have to lock up the food because you don't trust that nature will take care of you. And so nature in this representative is God. So like, there's a lot of interpretations that say, you know, modern interpretations of the Bible and that original sin that say like, it comes from shame and it comes from a lack of trusting God. Because if you're only Adam and Eve in a garden and all of a sudden you're ashamed of being naked, who are you ashamed in front of besides each other and God and the animals, right? Like, there isn't really that experience. So,
it's the invisible audience.
Yeah. And if you go to his Dark Materials, which are like the Golden Compass and that whole series that's on HBO, it's based on a book. They talk about a similar thing in which the original sin is actually repeated in every single person's life when they go through puberty. Because it's when they become ashamed of their nakedness and when they have to hide themselves and when they have to, what I say is they go into the mirror box of life where everything they see is a reflection of what they aren't.
Right. And I think a lot of that in middle school, you know, middle school is so hard. It's when you really make that external audience loud. Mm-hmm. Suddenly everything you do is being judged.
Exactly. Exactly.
So going back to the humiliation wound, as we spoke in the other episodes, each wound carries a mask. The mask is the way to protect oneself from those feelings. So the mask of the humiliation wound is the masochist. So they cause their own self-suffering.
Self-hatred.
Self-hatred. They punish themselves, you know. They're like, I'm so bad, let me punish myself. If I punish myself, I don't have to experience so much the guilt. I'm appeasing the guilt god, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to talk now about our own experience. That's okay. Okay. I want to talk about our own experiences of shame and guilt and humiliation in our own life. So as I said before, when I went into researching this topic, I thought I don't really have a lot of shame and guilt. But let's just see, you know, let's just see if I do. And I came to recognize I have shame and guilt in two different ways, or many different ways, but like one hallmark way that I was experiencing shame and guilt was through the inner voice, this inner voice in my head. And it was this inner voice that was critical. And to be totally honest with you, it wasn't till I got on antidepressants that my brain slowed down enough to hear the voice. Even though I meditate and I've observed the voice and in my everyday acting, living moments, that voice was just the fucking narrator of my life that I didn't see it as separate from me. But when I was able to slow it down and see it, I noticed that I had this voice in the back of my head. And anytime I fucked up, it was right there telling me, you fucked up. If I lost my temper with my kids, the voice is saying, you're a bad mom. You could have solved this problem in a different way. You're such a bad mom. You're such a bad mom. Such a shitty mom. Da da da. Rolling in that. What is that? The shame voice. Or say, for example, I'm reading my child a bedtime story and the shame voice comes in and says, think of all the times you could have read to your children. You know, reading to your children makes them smarter. Your poor children. Look what you've denied them. You've ruined their brain because you didn't read to them enough. Again, you know, this is ridiculous, but this is the thoughts I'm thinking, rolling in it. So as I started doing this self-research for the episode, I started noticing more and more the critical voice in my head telling me all these things, all these ways I have failed this invisible audience. This voice is like the invisible audience telling me all the ways I failed because I'm not living up to this perfect version of me. This perfect mother, this perfect wife, this perfect whatever it is. It was like I had this hierarchy in my brain of this person that I needed to be, that I'm never going to be her. And the voice constantly reminding me, you should be ashamed. you should be guilty. You are not that thing that you strive to be, you know? That was a huge wake-up call, was to see that. And that voice causes so much of my suffering. Like 99% of my suffering, that my self-inflicted suffering, non-interpersonal, is from this fucking voice. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get into that more later. So, okay, number one was the voice. Number two was actually my student loan debt. So in a string of events, again, let's call them omens, my daughter was assigned to watch Cinderella by her acting coach. And we're watching Cinderella together. And at the same time, I'm kind of like rebudgeting my life and looking at how I'm going to pay off my student loans and yada, yada, yada. And I wanted to get a new car and like, can I make it work and yada, yada, yada. And I started rolling into my student loan debt. And I started to recognize that I was so ashamed. I did not come from a family that paid for my university. I came into my marriage with enormous medical school debt from a very expensive university. I came into my marriage with that and I felt a lot of shame for it. I was not even aware that I felt the shame, and I would manifest it with masochism by literally being Cinderella in my own home. I would not let myself relax because shame is a lot about not enjoying, not having pleasure. Like, I'd be like, you can't relax unless the house is clean. Just like Cinderella lived in a beautiful home and was always cooking and cleaning and doing all these things, I did that too. Like, I live in a beautiful home and I've never felt like it's my home. I feel like a maid in my own home. My husband didn't do that. My kids don't do that. I've done it to myself because of the shame I felt for having student debt.
So, and it's interesting from my perspective too, because in the same way that Anna can see my creative self-sabotage, I could see her continual, like literally every single thing that she talked about was, I'm going to do this so I can pay off my debt. And I thought it was so interesting because I was just like, one of these days, I don't know how she's going to do it. I know she's going to do it because I have ultimate faith in her ability to like recognize her kind of like obsession or the thing that is like her kind of like my creative self-sabotage. It's like her thing. And her thing was all about student debt and how am I going to pay off my student debt? And it was such a, I always thought of her, she's such a business savvy person in the sense that she's like, I never put any money into something until it gives me money back. And I was like, that's so amazing. And then right behind that is always, and this is how it's going to pay for my student debt. And I'm just like, we need to get, and as student debt, and there's been so many opportunities in which people should have like, I feel like there's been numerous opportunities over the years for your debt to magically go away. And yet it hasn't happened yet.
Right.
And I'm guessing it's going to happen now. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, yeah, well, that's totally a side note, which is that I'm a great manifester. If I want something, I've been able to manifest it. I have not been able to make a dent in my student loans.
Yeah.
And why? Because it was a gift for me to finally recognize my self-shame and to see the ways that I am tied up in humiliation and that I let my self-worth be tied up in debt. And for me, it's student debt. For other people, it might be class. It might be age. It might be beauty. It might be intelligence. It might be sense of humor. It might be ableism. There's so many ways we hold ourselves to impossible standards. Oh, I don't look like a supermodel. There's the beauty one. Oh, I am of a low class and there are people of higher classes. That's another one. I am of a higher class, but I feel guilt for being in the higher class when other people are suffering. So I will suffer for that. Like, just whenever you have any kind of hierarchy, you freaking create suffering. And as a side note, student loan debt is enormous in the United States. Nearly 45 million borrowers in the United States with nearly $2 trillion of student loan debt is in there. There are so many people stuck in that. And it's not just like the financial burden of debt and making decisions based on debt. There's a lot of self-worth that goes into it too. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of looking at someone who has no debt and being like, wow.
Especially because you're told that the American dream is put all this money into your college loans, and then you're going to come out of it, and you're going to be great because you're going to get this job that pays them off easily. But that's a sham. Like, ultimately, that's a sham these days. And, you know, for whatever reason, it's the way that we've built things up, but I won't even get into that.
But we don't even need to get into the debt. We don't even need to get into the student loan debt. It could be a beauty. It could have been anything. I decided to cause a lot of self-suffering and tether myself to the shame wound through the student loan debt. It could be for someone else. It could be beauty. It could be body weight on a scale. It could be intelligence. It could be likability. I mean, there's just so many things you can do whenever you make a hierarchy.
Yep. And so do you want me to describe mine now?
Yeah. It's Chris's turn.
no, because I have a very similar voice to what Anna has. I think the motherhood one in particular is the motherhood and wife one. And just like generally being a bad person is something that I continually shame myself for, especially when I get into like really bad places and I just like get so angry or I get so tired and I like lose my temper and all that kind of stuff. But the one that I want to talk about, I was driving to go meet Anna last night and I realized that there's two ones that I have in particular, but both of them surround privilege. One of them is about white privilege and the other one is about economic privilege. Because I feel continually, and I felt this even before anything that's happened in the last couple of years. I think it's just given me access. What's all the external activity that's happened has given me access to this. But I've always felt that it wasn't fair. This kind of leads into injustice a lot, but like it wasn't fair that I was born on third base.
What's that mean?
Born on third base is like it's a common white privilege way to describe it, to basically say you think you were born on third base and you think you hit a triple, like in baseball, right? Mm-hmm. But you didn't. You were born on third base, right? And everybody else is sitting here trying to bat, trying to hit a home, you know, trying to hit a double or a single or anything, even just to get on base. And you're sitting here on third base, being like, "Look at me, I'm on third base. I'm so great," right? And I used to continually say stuff like, you know, we didn't have anything when I was little or which is true, like, you know, whatever. Like I didn't get a pair of like soccer shorts. Like, come on, let's talk about, you know, like Umbros were really popular when I was a kid. And I remember all the other kids because I went to a private school that my grandparents paid for because my dad was a single dad and he could only work a certain number of hours a week. And when he got together with my stepmom when I was 13, like everything changed. We became middle class, whatever you want to call it, right? And I never felt comfortable with it. So even now, I've lived on food stamps. I remember at a time when I was living in Indiana and I would get $20 an hour and I would make $150 a day. And it was literally, I could live off $150 a week. Like that's how little I had. And I was living off grid. So we weren't having to pay rent. And we basically lived off of nothing. We lived off of Chump, which is what this grocery store called all their like damaged goods. We lived off of Chump and food stamps and my like $150 a week and like Luke's whatever, my husband's like whatever. I think I purposely put myself into that so that I could feel like I could justify the economic privilege that I had in my life. Like the humiliation was so intense that that's where I had to go with it. And so even now, I like had the most amazing place. Like I absolutely feel so privileged to have this place. And like every single worker who comes.
Your AR farm.
Every single worker who comes out here is just like, this place is so amazing. It's so beautiful. Like everyone's
it's amazing.
It's just like, it's so incredible. And you know, but it's always, it's so funny.
But you're always focusing on
what needs to work, what needs to be fixed.
Like, the pool's a mess.
The pool's a mess and it's a manufactured home and stuff like that. But all of that is probably
and
still
and I never wouldn't even notice it's a, I wouldn't even, I didn't even, I had to Google what is a manufactured home because it's so out of my like,
right.
I don't care.
Yeah. And I like, and I see all these, I'm surrounded by people who are totally okay with their wealth. They're totally okay with having really nice things. I could never imagine buying a new car. Like I literally am just like, for one thing, I'm like, that's such a waste of money. But like, that's like my dad's like economic management coming in here. But like, I could never, ever imagine having a new car. I could never imagine having a house like my sister's. So I would feel so much like my sister
has been so good about, like, she's just accepted whatever has come into her life, and she's so good at manifesting it, and she knows what she wants. And every single time, Lyra had 3 birthdays at her house. Because I was so ashamed of my house and like how it wasn't decorated and how it wasn't a good space. And I would always use these excuses. It may have just been 2, but it was a lot. And I'm so grateful to my sister for hosting those, because that was representative of my shame. Like, Lyra was going to a school that was in the city where it was like full of, it was a free pre-K program, but like she was with people who lived in these really rich neighborhoods. And I didn't want, like, my houses aren't bad, but like I felt so much shame at not having a house that was like my sister's, that she was just so generous to have offered up her space so that I didn't have to feel that shame. But it was like a self-imposed, it was so messed up.
It's all self-imposed.
It is. And I could go into it forever, and I could also go into the whole white privilege thing, which I will when I talk later. But like, yeah, I have massive money humiliation shame issues, and I'm continually trying to live on nothing or to not have a lot, just to make up for whatever I feel like I should be ashamed of.
So now the question is, how do we heal the shame wound or the humiliation wound? How do we heal it? And by healing it, we mean forgiving it, bringing insight to it. And I can't say I healed it, and I can't say I'll ever heal it, because it is the food that propels me into the next house.
Exactly.
It is the house builder. And until I'm enlightened, I'm going to have shame. And I'm okay with that. I recognize, as long as I'm in a human body and I am not enlightened and I am tethered to this world, I'm going to have some shame. And that's okay. But I'm going to show you what I'm doing now to help it. Okay. Number one is, or I should say there's 3 things. Number one is noticing it. Like, just recognizing.
Awareness.
Awareness. Just mm-hmm. recognizing shame in my life. Recognizing when, what kind of things are happening. And as a result of shame, like the student debt and, you know, motherhood, whatever. Just recognizing it. That's a big, huge one. Number two is, I bought a book, a cognitive behavioral therapy book called Overcoming Unwanted Intrusive Thoughts by Dr. Winston and Dr. Seif. And I'm using that book. I've actually only read the first chapter. I wanted to read the whole book before this episode. So if the book is awesome, I'll do an entire episode just on intrusive thoughts. What I've read so far is very interesting. It says that there are 3 voices in our heads: the worried voice, the false comfort, and the wise voice. The worried voice is the voice who constantly shames us. Oh, this is going to happen if you don't do this. Oh, you're a terrible mother. Yada, yada, yada. The false comfort is the voice that responds and says, oh, no. Oh, no. You're wrong. No, no, no. I'm a good mom. See, I do this and I do that. Well, what have we been talking about all along? Whatever you resist gets stronger. If you push against that voice, you make that voice stronger. So ironically, the false comfort voice is making the worried voice, or I'll call it the shame voice, stronger. Shame voice comes in. No, 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 no. I don't need to be ashamed. Oh, no, no, no. I am a good mother. Oh, no, 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 no. Student debt doesn't define me. No, I'm fucking making that voice stronger. Mm-hmm. So what do I need to do instead? I need to sink back into the wise voice and just observe it. So what I've been doing, the book, I don't know if the book says to do this or not, but this is just from my own teachings from the monk in episode 1. When that voice comes up and starts shaming me and telling me all the ways I failed, I say, thank you for sharing. I love you. Thanks for sharing. Because if I try to throw back at it all the facts why it's wrong, it's just going to get stronger and louder and more intense. So I just, when I hear it, I'm just like, thank you. I love you. Thank you. And last night, like earlier you asked me how my night's sleep was, I woke up at 1 a.m. and I slept in a hotel last night. I very rarely leave my family because I have major abandonment wound stuff and I fear abandoning my family. So in my 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. wake up in the middle of the night, I wake up with a slew of thoughts. And they're like, Eric has this, by the way, my husband would never do this. So it was totally ridiculous. But it was like, your husband, because he didn't respond to my text before bed that said goodnight. I was like, Eric has taken the kids. He's changed all the locks on the doors. I'm going to come back tomorrow and no one's going to be there. And I just had this over and over and over again thoughts, like totally illogical thoughts that my family wasn't going to be there when I come back tomorrow. And I was like, no, no, that's not true. Eric wouldn't do that. And the voice got longer and louder and louder and louder. And that critic voice was like yelling in my ear. And I swear it was to prepare me for this episode. It was like yelling in my ear. No, Anna, he is going to leave you and he's going to take the kids and he's going to hire a better lawyer and he's going to keep the kids and you're not going to have anything. And it just got so loud. And I'm like, oh my God, my heart's racing. Ridiculous thoughts, right? But yeah. If I told that myself, it was ridiculous. It was just going to make it stronger.
It was just going to make it stronger. Yeah.
So I just was like, I'm going to just listen to you. I'm just going to listen to you. And I let that shame voice just go nuts and yell at me and tell me all the ways I was horrible. And I just listened and listened. And then when I was like, who is behind this? Who are you behind there? Where are you coming from? Like, who are you? And I didn't get any answers. But I just started saying, whoever you are, I love you. I love you. Whatever you need, what you need is love and validation. And I'm loving you and I'm validating you. And I'm not going to tell you it's going to be okay. And I'm not going to tell you that you're wrong. I'm just going to tell you, whoever you are, I love you. I just kept saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. And it quieted down and I was able to go back to sleep. Ugh,
that's amazing. Good work.
Yeah. And she might be back tonight.
She might be back tonight, right?
And I just got to keep loving whoever she is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because she's a part of you that feels not whole.
Yeah.
Right? She's a whole that feels not whole. So, yeah. So, for me, I'm in a similar place to Anna when it comes to healing my humiliation. I feel like even in just saying all the stuff I just said, I became more aware of the shit that I do. But what I wanted to talk about is the healing that I did with the Black Lives Matter movement last year and with white guilt, white shame, white privilege. Because having grown up in Atlanta, you live, this is what me and some people call it, is like there's a pain body that surrounds Atlanta. And this is the pain body is a term that comes from The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. It's this basic idea that there is a consciousness, there's a morphogenic field, there's a bunch of different words for it, but there's a skin that sits above Atlanta that holds on to all of the pain and suffering of racial inequality that exists in the city. One thing I can say is that I know someone who's recently moved out of the country and moved out. They've lived in Atlanta their whole lives and they've moved out of the country. And they're just like, it's so different because I don't have to live in that field. Like, it's a completely different feeling. Like, everyone's just happy because they've processed, like the collective had processed all of their stuff. But Atlanta is still in the thick of processing it. And it's still in the thick of all the injustice and the throes and all that different stuff is still going on. And so having grown up with both the economic shame as well as the white shame, to the fact where during the Black Lives Matter movement, I was walking down the road and I saw a sticker on the back of like a graffiti sticker, and it said, it's okay to be white. And I was like, really? Is it okay to be white? Like, because I don't feel like it's okay to be white. Like, I don't feel like that. So I was really just feeling this, like, wanting to do something, wanting to do whatever, and just feeling so, so guilty for being white, and knowing that that wasn't what the conversation was about, knowing that the conversation was not about how guilty I feel about being white. It was about how do we make things better? And like, how do we, like, you know, like, I recognize that like my experience of white guilt was not what the conversation was about. It was about me doing the work to move out of white guilt into a place where I could be an ally and an advocate. And I didn't have to, like, and I could just constantly be ashamed if I didn't show up in the right way. And I'd be okay with that, right? Like, being uncomfortable was a part of that conversation, right? And that's what I think, I talked with somebody about it during the time, and we're just like, it feels like nothing we can do is right. And we're like, oh shit, that's what we're supposed to do. Like, that's what's supposed to happen. Like, we're supposed to feel like nothing we're doing is right. We're supposed to feel uncomfortable in this position because we've never not felt comfortable. Like, we've always felt comfortable. And the whole point is for us to move into a space where we're sharing the burden of discomfort so that we can help process it. Anyway, that's the way I approached it. And that's totally fine if that's wrong. I will take that shame. Like, you know what I mean? But one of the things that happened last year that I had to do, because I felt this burden of, like, I felt this pain body and it was encroaching on my aura in the craziest way. Like, I just felt so, like, I felt like I had this, like, I felt like I had this voice in the back of my head telling me that I needed to be ashamed for being white, telling me that I needed to pay for my crimes, telling me that I needed to do this. And I think a lot of that was that pain body that sits in Atlanta. I didn't feel it when I lived in Indiana. It was completely out of my mind. Like, it just, I lived in the country. It wasn't even a thing, right? I feel it a little bit here because I think it's really big and I'm just outside of Atlanta. But what I did was I had to go and I meditated because I'm like, I'm sick of this. I'm sick of this. Like, I'm okay with feeling uncomfortable, but I also don't want to feel like I'm inferior just because of something that I can't even control. Like, I don't even think I can control it, right? I can do whatever I can to negate it, and I can do whatever I can to process it, and I can do whatever I can to help other people who are experiencing this injustice, but I don't want to feel this every day. And so what I did was I basically was like, all right, show yourself. Like, who are you? Who are you, this person who's just in the back of my head being like, you need to be ashamed of your whiteness? And
what? Oh, she's the one who was in my head last night.
Yeah, right. It's the same one, right? She's just like, it's a certainly different thing. And this utterly fucking incredible black goddess comes down from on high. And she's just totally, she's a little bit like Kali or the Black Madonna. Like, that's what I kind of think of her as. Like just stunning. Just absolutely incredible. But also, like, this representative of this feeling of white guilt and like the self-imposed inflictor of white whatever. And I was just like, forgive me I did it first. I was like, forgive me. I'm so sorry for all this. Like, I feel so ashamed for being white. I feel so ashamed for what's happened. I feel so ashamed for what my ancestors inevitably did. And I know that we're all supposed to be one. And I know that in another life I was black. And I know that in another life I was a slave. And I know that in another life, but like, none of that matters because in this current incarnation, I'm me. I'm white. I am I'm a daughter of the American Revolution. I'm a daughter of the Confederacy and the Union. I'm a daughter of all these things. Like, my family has 500 fucking years in this country of oppression. And, you know, and she's like, it's not my job to forgive you, is what she said. At first she was like listening and she was like it was kind of like an experience of like really addressing my shadow, that part of my shadow, but also like I was relinquishing all my power to her to forgive me. And she's like, this is not my job. She's like, my job is not to forgive you. This is the whole thing. My job is not to forgive you. Your job is to forgive yourself because I should not have the burden of having to forgive you. I have my own stuff that I have to forgive. And like, yeah, sure. You know, if I could throw away a forgiveness to say I forgive you, but really this is all about you. You are imposing your self-hatred and it is your work to do. It is not mine. And I was like, fuck, okay. My job. Mm-hmm. I have to forgive myself. And it lessened so much. Like, it's not gone by any means, but it lessened significantly to have this experience to recognize that the shame is nobody's responsibility but you to get rid of.
Right.
You have to accept it and forgive it within yourself. And to place that burden on somebody else is just, it's just an energetic crush. It's just, it's not responsible. You're not being responsible for your own energy. So, yeah.
Yeah. I get it. I had to forgive my debt. I had to forgive my family. I had to forgive myself. And that burden of shame is less, much less, mm-hmm. you yeah. know, in a way that someone just paying off my student debt never would have done. Mm-hmm. So, hey, it's a gift. I have another way I want to just discuss real quick how I've been working on my shame, which was I did a regression meditation where I went back to understand more about my shame. And I went back and I saw three different lifetimes where I experienced shame. In one, I was in a pre-Columbian Mayan community where I accused my aunt of being possessed. Mm-hmm. And she ended up being publicly executed. And I felt very shameful for that.
Yep.
And the second one, I experienced seeing my husband sexually assault one of our mm-hmm. our employees, like a stable girl. And I said nothing and I live my life with the shame of that. And in a third one, I was responsible for the death of many people. And in all three of them, there was this understanding that like hierarchy brings shame. So when I came out of the regression, I called upon Archangel Michael, who is my
main guy,
my main squeeze.
He's
my main squeeze. And I was like, okay, Archangel Michael, I saw these memories. I still don't know, like, what am I supposed to do with all this? Mm-hmm. And he says to me, I want you to see this. And he shows me an image of it, like an X and Y axis. You could say it's a cross. You could say it's like the letter T, but it was like an X and a Y, a line going straight down, a line going on the vertical, and a line going straight across on the horizontal. And he says to me, all human beings are on the horizontal. He says, every human being exists on the X axis. We are all on the same exact plane. And and shame occurs when you put people above you or below you. If you put them above you, the pendulum's going to swing and eventually you're going to be below. I'm sorry. If you put them below you, the pendulum's eventually going to swing and you're going to be below them. And if you put them above you, you're putting yourself below you. Like, anytime you put humans in a hierarchy scale on the Y-axis, on the vertical, you're creating a hierarchy, you're creating a structure where shame is inevitable to follow, because you are going to feel inferior eventually. Okay. Eventually. That could be an invisible person, like the perfect quintessential mother that doesn't even exist that I've put on the Y. Or let's say your issue is beauty. You know, you put this quintessential beautiful version of you on the Y and then you're below. So anytime you're putting anyone real or unreal above you or below you, you're eventually going to feel inferior. So he's like, no, Anna, everyone is on the X axis. It is the angels and God who are on the Y. They are the only ones above you. But as far as human beings goes, you got the murderer, you got the saint, you're all on the X axis. Some might be to the left of you in some things. Some might be to the right of you, but you're all on the X axis. And if you just pause and breathe that in, it's an energy thing. We are all on the X axis. Like, we are all on the X axis. We are all on the horizontal. No one's better than anyone else. No one's worse than anyone else. And there's no perfect version of Anna out there who's better than me. Mm-hmm. Everyone is just here and it's okay. And so one way that I'm using that to deal with my own shame is I'm reminding myself I am on the X axis and so is everyone else. I have a patient who is extremely difficult to work with. And if I am 5 minutes late, he will yell at me and he will belittle me and he will treat me like crap. And I put up with it because in my hierarchy, he is my patient and I am his servant and I am below him. And I was on my way to work yesterday and I was right on time, but I knew if I was 2 minutes late, he was going to berate me. And I'm driving and I'm like, if he berates me, I'm going to leave because I am on the X axis and so is he. I don't need to put myself below him.
Yeah.
And so that was a big deal for me. So like Archangel Michael sending me that image of the cross of the horizontal and vertical axis and just remembering no one's above me but God and the angels. It's amazing. And like I was judging another person very harshly. Someone did something that hurt my feelings and I was thinking that person shouldn't have done X, Y, and Z. All this shame. He shouldn't have done this. Why? Because I was holding him up to an impossible version of the perfect version of himself on the Y-axis. I was holding him up to the Y-axis. He doesn't exist on the Y. He's only on the X. He is only who he is. So yeah. If I can just love and forgive him for being who he is on the X-axis, there's no shame and there's much less suffering.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So to wrap up this very long episode.
Yeah, but totally worthwhile because it is such the deep wound. Yeah.
Yes. You're going to hear rain in the back now.
It's pouring.
It's pouring over here. To wrap it up, we will have in our show notes links to meditations that can help you process and recognize your own shame and guilt. I think the take-home message here is insight, which is awareness of it, forgiveness, loving it. Don't fight it. Just love it.
Yep.
Accept it.
And recognize that by us having this episode and by you listening to it, we are giving you access to your humiliation wound. And
just like the omens, you brought us in.
You brought us in, right? Like if you're listening to this, you're ready to hear it, right? You're ready to do whatever. And if you've been listening to all the wounds in a row, just know that you can set stuff aside, if you know what I mean, because we're giving you access to all five wounds. And for both of us, it's taken us a year to process all of these wounds, right? Like, it's taken us, this is a lifetime work, and I think it will keep coming back around and around and around and around again. Because if you want to say that the five traumas or the five wounds are the base of so much of our suffering, they're basically big buckets that we can put our suffering into. And if we are slowly emptying the bucket and not filling it up again, and using that as our way to access how to become more humble, how to become more grateful, how to become more forgiving, how to become more accepting, then this is how we're choosing. And if you're listening to this, this is also maybe how you're choosing. So if you don't feel like you can deal with humiliation right now, that's okay. Set it aside and say to yourself and to your higher self, I'm going to close this door and I'm going to concentrate on abandonment or something like that. And so then when you're ready to pick it back up again, then you can then listen to this episode again and you can regain the access. It's basically like a gateway is what we're giving you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And remember,
humility, gratitude, acceptance, done.
Let me tell you all a riddle. There are four girls and four apples in a basket. Every girl takes an apple, yet one apple remains in the basket. How is this possible? The answer? One girl took the basket. She took the last apple while it was in the basket. Sometimes all it takes is a perspective shift. This is my specialty, y'all, and I am opening up two spots in the next 2 months for dedicated journeyers to work with me to find peace, purpose, and most importantly, perspective. In these journeys, we co-create a curriculum that suits your current blocks, goals, and needs, and we use all the tools, shadow work, books, fiction, remote viewing, intuition, meditation, guided journeys, energy healing, dreaming techniques, you name it, we do it. And all to achieve a commonly held set of objectives. And if you're interested in hearing more, book a free call with me at www.chriswiltsy.com/discover.